Welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors. For each episode, we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at director Lucy Molloy and her 2012 film, Una Noche. Returning on the show today to talk about Una Noche is Professor Marie Westhaver. Professor Westhaver, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
You know, it's interesting. Just before you came in here, I was reading a little article about the movie The Crow, and they were talking about how it's kind of strange how that movie, art imitates life. And like, in this movie, doing if you do some backstory on it, it's a lot of art imitating life because I believe two of the actors in that movie, around this time this movie was being made, tried to defect to America from Cuba.
Yeah, they actually came to the Tribeca Film Festival to show the movie, and the two leads who play the twins asked for political asylum. They didn't even go to the festival. They didn't go to the festival to see their own movie because this was their shot. And they didn't tell anybody either, so everybody involved with the film, as far as they knew, they arrived in New York, and then these two just disappeared. So everybody was panicking for like 3 days until they discovered the real reason.
So as of right now, they're in America?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And they're having, apparently they're expecting twins.
Oh, well, good for them. You know, that's what's so interesting about this movie, because when you, it's almost like when you, once you know the story, what's actually behind it, it just makes the movie that much more interesting, where it's, I'm not really sure if, I'm pretty sure they didn't do this whole thing where they had to go on the little, you know, rowboat and everything, but still, it just makes it much more fascinating.
It is. It's an interesting story, because you know, even when they say, you know, the United States is only 90 miles away, that doesn't sound that far. That does sound like you could go for it. It doesn't sound that bad. And then you realize what it really involves, and you think, oh my God, that takes an incredible amount of courage.
Especially when all you got is just a little, you know, blow up boat, you know, and just, you know, once again, you're going through the waters, you don't know if sharks are going in there, and they could easily tear that thing apart.
Yeah, and they lose their GPS,
and then the
motor doesn't work, and everything goes wrong.
Yeah. So it's interesting. How did Cuba react to this film?
You know, it's hard to say because we don't get a lot of information out of Cuba about what's really, you know, how the movie did. I don't even know if it opened in Cuba, come to think of it.
But I do know, sort of last few years, I know our relations with Cuba has sort of lessened. You kind of actually see that in movies. Like in Mission Impossible 5, there's a little segment when he's hiding out in Havana, and like Fast and Furious 8 or whatever it is now, I've lost track. But like they're drag racing somewhere in Cuba, so it seems that relations a little bit are improving. So I wonder if they're a little bit more open to it now.
Oh, I think that things that definitely have improved. But you know, one thing that's a big takeaway from the movie is how impossible it is to live there. You know, it just makes it look really desperate. And Lucy Molloy spent a year in Cuba, and put the three leads together as often as she could to get them to get to know each other so they'd be believable as brother and sister and, you know, the sort of romance between the two guys, at least the friendship between the two guys. So she spent some time there trying to make it really authentic, and they cast people that were just regular folks. These are not professional actors. So they went places where teenagers congregate, like concerts and movie theaters and parties and stuff like that, and just tried to get regular folks off the street. So it has that ring of authenticity. And of course, they shot it in Cuba, so you have real shots of real places. So in some ways, for you know the armchair traveler in all of us, who you know you're never going to go to Cuba because the country, our country won't let you, or it's too difficult, or you don't speak Spanish, all the reasons, you can still see what it looks like for some people the very first time. And one thing I found very interesting in it is you do see tourists there. You see American tourists there. And they're clueless. And they have no idea what's going on. And they are living like at the top level of what you can do there when you've got money. You know, well, you don't see any Cuban people on jet skis.
I thought they were British.
Oh, maybe they're British.
Because I know the whole thing is we can't go, but I think it's, I forget, like if you fly to Britain somewhere and be able to get your visa or something, you can go from Britain to Cuba. If I'm not mistaken, or I could be completely wrong. I know Britain and Cuba, you can go, but Americans, you would have to go to London and then fly to Cuba.
Okay, see, I'm
not 100% sure on that.
There's probably, some way around it. The what makes it important is that they speak English. So at the very end of the movie, you think they've made it to Florida.
Nope. They're right back. And somewhat a bit similar to a movie we talked about earlier with Before Night Falls, which is kind of talks about the same thing. you know, mishandling of the government and then just people trying to get to America. And of course, before Night Falls, they succeed, but still kind of goes through the same issues.
You know what I noticed about this movie in particular, especially watching it again, is one thing. Before Night Falls is all about a guy who's gay and needs to leave that country because they don't tolerate homosexuality. But in this movie, they show so much sex in the beginning of Cuba because it is the only way to make a living. And, you know, for some people, I read reviews, people commenting on that, like, well, did they really have to, you know, emphasize that so much? I think you do, because you have to realize the grisliness of this is your option, you know, selling your body. Mm-hmm. If you're a man, you might even have to sell it to men, even if you're not homosexual. And one of the main characters' mother has AIDS, and there's all kinds of consequences that you see, but you also see it's a complete trap, and you have to acknowledge that when you realize it's one of the reasons why people are just desperate to get out of there.
Yeah, and it's never, like, when they show it, it's never meant to be, like, you know, erotic or anything. It's very, like you said, seedy and
depressing. You know, you find your parent out, you know, cheating on the other parent. You see it. You
find your mom with the guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, like, it show, like, really shows sort of how, like, the alienation of youth in this movie. It's very youth oriented, where everybody, like, you see why all of them want to get out.
Mm-hmm.
You see, like, you know, the sister and the brother, you know, their bad relationship with the parents, father's having an affair, the other guy, his mom's a prostitute, and they're stuck working a crap job, and that's how they want to get out. Now, you know, the interesting is the sister says, well, you know, there's no guarantee we're going to do any better over there. But it's even still, it's just like, it's still better than it is here.
Right. I mean, you at least have to try. I mean, that's actually one of the things that kind of sums up the youth aspect of it, is there is that idea of optimism. It hasn't been completely beaten out of them yet. And that idea that, you know, maybe someplace else will be different. And so you want to at least try, even if you think it's hopeless. And one of the things that I thought was interesting about the ending, and lots of people didn't even understand that they ended up right back where they started from, is for a moment you have a glimpse of what it might be like if they had made it, because there would still be people on the jet skis who have no idea. And your status in life could still be on the bottom rung. It'd just be in a different place.
Yeah, you would, like she said, you'd probably be just doing with the same job, working in the kitchen.
Some crappy kitchen, illegally, always looking over your shoulder, always wondering when the law was going to catch up with you.
And the minute you screw up or get sick, you're gone. And
yeah.
It kind of, once again, a little bit similar to another film, was El Norte,
yes,
where he's working this job. It seems like he's moving up, but the minute he gets sick or has to take a day off, or he leaves because the police went after him, he's lost the job forever.
Or even a better life where, you know, you do make it. You are, you know, living on the fringe of society, and you're doing all right. And then you buy a truck, and somebody steals it, and now if you deal with law enforcement, you are jeopardizing everything.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the film is sort of with the tensions between, you know, it's two guys and a girl, just like in the movie Me Too, Mama Tom Beyond. They go on a trip. There's sort of this tension, sexual tension between all of them. And I just, when I was watching this film, I couldn't help but think of that movie.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I hadn't put that together, but it's a great analysis. Because in that movie, there is that resentment of the girl between, you know, the guy who wants the other guy all to himself. Mm-hmm. I do want to ask you, what do you think of the relationship, if you want to call it that, between the two male leads? You have one real tough guy who's, you know, Mr. Big, and it's all his big plan.
Yeah.
He's the one who wants to escape, and he's the one with the most to lose because he has been, you know, accused of a crime he didn't commit.
Yeah, and it's interesting because he, you know, there's sort of evidence that he might also be, like, in the closet, so to speak, because there's the scene when he's picking up the girl, but he realizes it's a guy, and then he gets all disgusted when a minute later he was hitting on her. And then, you know, one of the things he remarked to the other girl is like, oh, I like the hair on your arms. So there's a little, it was interesting, there's a little bit of evidence that he's probably gay, but he just doesn't realize it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you have to think that he's got to know. Well, maybe he doesn't. He does seem surprised when the brother comes on to him later. But really, he didn't suspect the thing?
Yeah, it's just, like I said, it's interesting. Like, maybe he's just not coming to terms with it yet.
And the brother, Elio, he seems, I think he's just going to follow Raoul anywhere.
Yeah.
I don't think he really cares what the plan is. I think he's in love with him.
Yeah, he was going to follow him anywhere. And, you know, even though he tried to make the move on him and he pushed him away, he's still probably going to, he would have, because, of course, he doesn't last in the movie. Spoiler alert.
Yes. And the relationship between the sister and the brother and the sister and the third wheel, I think, is also very interesting, especially at the end, because the way they are with each other at the end is completely different from the way they start off. You know, they're sort of bonded by their shared experience and loss.
Yeah, they were always fighting each other for most of the movie, but now that they've had this experience and now that the other guy's gone, it seems that now they're, yeah, like you said, they've grown to like each other.
Yeah, but it's still doomed because, you know, now they're back in Cuba and he's going to have to face, you know.
Yeah, the last shot we see is him going in a cop car. And what's interesting about this film, it seems like it has a very specific criticism of Cuba, is that it has a strong focus on tourism. You see the way they really treat the tourists to the way they treat their own people, because you see a lot of, you know, the British tourists around, and when even one of them is just asking one of the guy for directions, the other guy is like, hey, what are you doing? Leave her alone. You know, she's just asking the guy for directions. So it seems that they really, and the main driving force of this movie is that he accidentally, the tourist gets injured, but they think he did it, even though he was just in the vicinity, he didn't even touch him. So once again, they're really, it's basically the tourists are the most important thing, and if they get hurt, it's more important for their safety than our own people.
Yeah, and what is not really explicitly spelled out, but is kind of obvious, is that a lot of these tourists are there for sex tourism.
Yeah, that's
you
what
know,
the one
I mean,
guy
this
did
guy
for the
is,
mom.
You know, he's with her mom. His mom has AIDS, so he is. I mean, you would think if you could make a list of desirable tourists, that wouldn't be what you would want. But you know, I guess money's money.
Money's money, and it's interesting. If you know, when I talk about a lot of these movies, one of the criticisms I have is whenever they show the American actors, that they're these very, you know, they're just not very good. They're very awkward. And I still probably going to have, it's not as bad because, but one thing I wrote, they do spend a little bit too much time on the tourists. Like, I remember they show the family and they're fighting and then she goes out asking for directions. And it made me think they were going to play a bigger part in the story. But then, that's all you see of them. I could be wrong, but is it a different family that was riding the jet ski at the end that picks them up?
No, it's the same.
Oh, okay.
And that I
was
think
that
is
the
why
payoff?
That was the payoff. Okay. Because you have to see, because first you're thinking, what do these people have to do with it except for contrast? Because while people are suffering and selling their bodies, other people are jet skiing.
Yeah.
You know, having a great time, and they don't even see that, much less accept it. And then at the end, it has to be those people because otherwise, you're not going to understand that they made it. They didn't make it. That they ended up right back in Cuba. And some people were confused about the movie. They thought they made it to Florida, and I think it's because they weren't paying attention earlier to that tour. Because probably this is some side story, but it's important because when you come back to it, you realize, oh wait, we saw them earlier. We're still in Cuba.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe it's just a pet peeve of mine, but whenever you have the movies where it's mainly focusing on, you know, foreign language speaking actors, and then it was like maybe some plots involving American actors or English speaking actors. It's just the contrast of the English speaking actors. They just feel really awkward and bad performance and stilted, than where the foreign language speaking actors are very natural. And I still feel it for this movie. It could just be a pet peeve of mine. I could be the only one that feels like this, but I don't know. It's just always, I always get this feeling, and I still got it with this movie.
I think it worked in this movie, though, because it makes them seem off-putting, like even more off-putting, because they are, like I said, they're, you know, they're fiddling while Rome burns. They are having this grand old time. They're on vacation. And in the end, when they are, quote unquote, saving the people, all they're doing is returning them to the same nightmare. So, you know, having those American speaking or English speaking characters, I think, is important to show even when you're helping, you're not, you know, in this situation.
Yeah. And you even see them like when we first see them, they're driving this really nice sports car with a drop top convertible and everything. So once again, everybody else is in squalor. They got this, you know, nice sports car and they're going on this big, probably very expensive holiday.
Yes. Yes, and you know the kids in the family aren't even having a very good time, which is the other thing. You bring them all the way to Cuba, you'd think, wow, let's see something really different. But instead, they're recreating their luxurious life. They're just playing. They're just having a good old time.
That's what most kids are, though, on vacations. They never like where they're going.
Yeah, I don't remember ever being taken to Cuba, though. The Cuba's a lot different than going to Ocean City.
And what's also interesting is that, like you said, it gives us really an in-depth look at Havana. And not like you just said what we see with the characters, but even just sort of like the street life, like you said, like the beginning, like all the kids are diving into the water and having competitions. And then when they're running through the streets, you see like a bunch of people singing. There's like the one guy who's singing. And then you have like the beatbox kind of guy. And then you have like dancers. So it really kind of gives you sort of this, I guess,
vibrant
slice of life look at this, you know, Havana.
Right, not just squalor, but people living their lives and street life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one of the things we did at the end, we talked about how art imitates life, but this was also, it says at the end, it said it was based on a true story.
It's probably based on a thousand true stories.
So maybe that was it. I thought it was something extremely specific, and my questions was how much of it is autobiographical to Lucy Malloy?
None of it, because from what I understand, she's a British citizen who thought, you know, this is an area of the world that hasn't been addressed. So she made a point of it. She went to New York Film School, by the way.
Yeah, and I believe this movie she was mentored under Spike Lee.
Oh, no, I didn't know that. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, because I believe, I don't have it with me now, but the DVD cover, it says Spike Lee presents. I'm reading about it. She did mentor. And like you said, NYU, that's where famously Spike Lee went.
Exactly. Yeah. You're right. Now, they decided to shoot film instead of digital because she liked the way that looked. But she said, you know, they had no budget. So they had to do all this stuff by hand. So their DP created, you know, a makeshift periscope to do the underwater shots because they didn't have the money for underwater cameras. So that was sort of guerrilla filmmaking. And she said, you know, she didn't have Steadicam, so she just used rollerblades.
Wow, that's really DIY. That's like Godard really Breathless when he's actually shooting without the permits.
She also said that, they had no labs in Cuba to develop any of the films. They had to wait a week or more to get the film back to even see what they shot. And, of course, all the troubles of making sure you ship things that aren't X-rayed and all of that kind of thing. So a lot of effort went into making this film.
Yeah, and once again, I'm really surprised that when they were doing this, that wonder how much like pressure or censorship they would have to face from the Cuban government. Because I imagine knowing them, they would say like, we may want to make sure you're not putting us in a really negative light.
Like, yeah.
You know, communism is good and everything, right? You know, that kind of thing. But anyway, like you said, I really like the cinematography. Like you said, it's very documentary style where everything's handheld. But even like the color palette, it reminded me a little bit of City of God, where City of God, it's like you can feel the heat in
and
that
the
movie.
Dust.
The dust. And everything has like this yellowish, goldish tint.
Yeah, you're right. It does have that same look. Maybe that is the look of slums.
Mm-hmm. Like in that movie, City of God, it's about the slums of Rio de Janeiro.
What do you think of this movie compared with something like Life of Pi?
That's interesting. Well, Life of Pi, the whole movie is about that journey on the boat. In this movie, it's only like the last, 20, 30 minutes that they actually get on the raft. It's mainly this whole movie is about what leads them to that. And this and Life of Pi, it's all about that journey. Of course, we realize different, like how it's different, but that journey and what it means to him. In this movie, it's about just what causes them to do that.
The look of the movie, though, totally different because, you know, Ang Lee makes it all sort of dreamlike, even all the vicious fish.
Yeah.
Yeah. He makes it sort of magical.
Yeah. Like when we had that little debate about whether Ready Player One was good or not. Like I said, that movie is all about the 3D. Life of Pi, obviously, about that 3D with all the colors of the the fish and like that specific scenes when the fish are coming at you.
Yes, yeah. And the sky above and the water below, you know, because Ang Lee goes both up and down, which is kind of, and they do that very minimally in this movie. Also, I thought about, because I was thinking about all the movies I've seen where people are stranded on, you know, in the open water, and I thought about, obviously, Alfred Hitchcock's Lifeboat. But that's black and white, so that's really hard to even compare. But then I thought about Unbroken. Did you see Unbroken?
No, not yet.
Well, that has a guy who survives that. But what's interesting about that in comparison to this is that he never gives up. And he prevails, even though it's an extremely difficult thing to endure. So while you're watching Una Noche, you can't help but think, you know, you really want them to make it. And even if it's hard, or even if something bad happens, you still want them to make it, because that's, you know, you always, it's that cliche that we're all in the same boat. I mean, literally,
yeah, literally
looking at a boat,
all in the same boat.
And you can't help but put yourself in it and think, what would I do? And what would I think? And what would I want? And how would I act? And another movie, of course, that I thought about was Castaway.
Oh, yeah.
Both the Tom Hanks movie, and there's a Korean film by the same name.
Oh, yeah, I think you told me about
it. We should talk about that on another show. It's a really interesting movie. It's called Castaway. And it's about a guy who decides he wants to commit suicide. And I believe he jumps off a bridge and he washes up on a little island where he can actually see the city. And the trash, of course, is washing up with him. And he can't get there, but he can see it. And it's really interesting. Of course, he tries to find ways to stay alive and how to send a message in a bottle and all that stuff. But it's a great philosophical movie about being stranded where you can still see the thing that you want. And that's one of the things that's going on in this movie, is you can't actually see it, but you know it's there. It's just there, like 90 miles, just right there.
Now, I know you're talking about something different when you're saying you can't actually see it, but that sort of leads into one of my criticisms I have is during that scene, especially at night when it's worrying about the shark attack. This could be my home video, but I had trouble. It was too dark. I had trouble seeing a lot, so I was really distracting. Like, what's exactly going on? Where they are in relation to where the shark is or the boat? Or who are the what characters are we seeing in the shot right now? Was this just me? Because I was watching and I thought they could have used a little bit more light because it was just too dark.
I think that's true of all movies. I think all movies could use a little more light. But in that scene, I think the sharks are circling.
There was more than one?
I thought there was more than one. Might have been just one.
Okay, because that's, once again, I thought it was, I couldn't see a lot. And that was a part like... What? Once again, it could be me.
It could also be that the director was trying to do a little dodge where, you know, you're trying to make a fake shark look real and you have to, you know, you make it kind of dark so you can't really see what's going on.
So once again, like you said, it's shot on a shoestring budget, so making the most of what they can do. Yeah. So I'm just glad they didn't do da-da, da-da.
But I think everybody plays that in their heads, so you don't have to do that anymore.
So... You know, since we're on the topic of Cuba, have you seen other Cuban films? I know the biggest one a lot of people talk about is a film that was co-produced with Russia, you know, kind of a communist sort of partnership or whatever. It was called Yo Soy Cuba.
I haven't seen it.
Oh, okay. I haven't seen it either, but I know that's like considered like this classic. Like, have you seen Boogie Nights?
Yes.
Okay, so that, you know, that big long take when they're at the pool party and everything, that was influenced by this movie. Apparently there's this like really classic long take. It's like of like the rich upper class during like pre-revolution Cuba, but I know that's supposed to be considered a classic.
Okay, I have not seen that. This is the only movie I've ever seen from Cuba.
Yeah, and speaking of only thing you've ever seen, I'm looking at Lucy Malloy. This was her first film. Mm-hmm. She did a couple, looking at her IMDb, she did a couple like short stuff. But this is 2012. We're 6 years later, and she hasn't done anything. There's nothing in pre-production, nothing planned or announced. I was curious, like, have you seen anything else she's done? Or?
No, I did watch some interviews with her where she said she was working on a new project that it was set in Rio, and that was all she wanted to say because she didn't want to jinx it.
And how long ago was this interview?
Was right after the movie came out.
Interesting. Once again, that was 6 years ago, and like, maybe she just scrapped it. Maybe she's done, you know?
Or maybe it got made and it was no good. Who knows? Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. I did want to choose this movie just because it's always interesting when you find somebody at the beginning of their career. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and she's writing the script and directing it. So that does take time.
Yeah, and You know, it's always interesting seeing how you have a, here's a director. She was influenced by a very famous director took her under her wing. This is interesting. Speaking of Spike Lee, did you get like any sort of Spike Lee influences from this movie?
I did not. Did
Me
you?
Me neither. No. I mean, maybe a little bit of Do the Right Thing, but I don't know.
Maybe, but even that's, yeah.
It's a bit of a stretch.
Yeah, a bit of a stretch because it's just not as hard hitting. Because I think the messages that it has are visual. Nobody makes a speech, you know, about, well, you know, we need to leave Cuba because there's no opportunity. Nobody makes that speech. Mm.
Okay, then. So getting close to my questions, is there anything else about this movie or Lisa Malloy or Cuba or anything that you want to bring up?
Well, there was one quote from Raul when Lila is confronting him about, you know, taking her brother away. And she says, what are you getting him into? And he says, nothing. I'm saving him. Now, given, you know, what eventually happens to poor Elio, do you think that that's still better? Or was he going to go down for, you know, theft and end up in prison in Cuba? So at least he got to try.
Yeah, I guess I would say at least he got to try.
Because especially with Elio, because he's homosexual and he was in the closet, you know, there's this decision you have to make about whether you're going to continue to hide or if you're going to make the last moments count. And if you could ask Elio, do you think he regretted?
I don't think so. He really wanted to go along, and what was left for him there anyway? He
right.
had a bad family. He had a bad job, or probably he was stuck there. Abusive boss. Knowing Cuba's treatment in the past, like we've seen with Before Nightfall, is how they treat gay people. So probably would have faced some sort of problems with the authorities. So go to America, hope for the best. Even if it won't work out, at least you tried, like
at
you said.
At least you tried.
I mean, getting eaten by a shark isn't the best thing in the world, but, you
is
know.
Is it better than a Cuban prison?
It's better than Cuba.
Better than Cuba. That's pretty bad. Mm-hmm. Being eaten by a shark is better than Cuba. That's the tagline, I guess. How sad is that? I have shown this in my class in World Cinema, but it did not go over well because I think everybody was totally wanting that American ending. You know, they really wanted them to make it, or at least some of them to make it.
Yeah, you know, you can't always have the happy ending. There's probably a lot of people who made that trip, and sometimes all they had was a little, you know, inflatable raft, and they don't make it. They either get shipwrecked or they go right back to where they came from.
I just want to say also that, and this is a trivial thing, but I thought it was awesome in terms of casting. I absolutely loved the main character, the girl's hair. Her hair was almost a character in itself.
Yeah, her hair definitely gets a lot. It gets in the way a lot, doesn't it?
It's great hair. Great hair movie.
Even better than the movie Hair. Yeah. Bad joke.
Or Good Hair, the Chris Rock movie.
Or Hairspray, Baltimore shout out. All right, then.
Or Harry Potter, never mind.
Okay. We're just getting really bad with the puns now, aren't we? But okay, then last question I'll have. Just tell us a little bit about your classes.
I teach, every semester I teach Intro to Film, American Cinema, and World Cinema. And in the fall 2018, I will also be teaching Film and Philosophy with Dr. Helen Mitchell, who is our philosophy guru here on campus. And we do talk about some of the movies we have discussed in this program, like Life of Pi and Castaway.
All right, sounds good. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been discussing director Lucy Malloy in her 2012 film, Una Noche. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under the category Armchair Directors. Best West, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying so long, and we will see you next week.